Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
Yo, yo, what's going on, everybody? Hope you're doing good and hope you having a good week so far. So before we get into the podcast this week, I'd love it if you could all go hit subscribe and give us a little comment or review or whatever your platform allows you to do. It just keeps the podcast going and I'd love you forever. Right, podcast time. Jake Hanrahan is a conflict journalist. I came across him on a podcast about a month ago and absolutely loved kind of what he was about and how he was talking. And I did some more digging and was really interested in what he's created. He's created a journalist platform called Popular Front, which reports on conflicts and issues that are going around in the world that mainstream media don't really talk about. And I'm not a huge fan of mainstream media. I just really like to kind of be given all the information and how it is with no political kind of sides taken. Jake does an amazing job and all of his guys at Popular Front do as well. He has a great podcast called Popular Front. He also has Patreon, which is Popular Front. So without further ado, I want to introduce you to Jake Hanrahan. Enjoy, people.
State of my hair, fuck that.
And we're live, mate. Your hair looks great. Don't worry about that.
Mate, no barbers on lockdown, mate. Only bootlegging. They're shit, man.
This beard is getting even bigger for like...
That's cool though, man. Can you put like a... Like, I was growing my beard up until recently and I wanted to put like a knot in it. But then I thought, no, just like a fucking like bootleg Viking, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and you just look like one of those hippies that just turns up somewhere walking down the... Like everyone's in like a local village or town has like a local hippie. And
yeah.
You're just like, I don't ever want to... Anyway, man, how are you?
I'm good, mate. I'm all right. I'm a bit annoyed today because... I meant to have a very big documentary coming out with my platform, Popular Front. And I sent it away to America to get it like professionally graded and colored and that. And I had to send it on a hard drive because the file was so big.
Yeah.
Paid about 200 quid, some extortionate rate to FedEx to get it sent back for this morning. Obviously, it hasn't arrived. Messaged them, just like, you know, rang them. And they're just like, yeah, like, no, we don't know where it is. I'm just like, fucking hell, mate.
That's ridiculous.
So I'm going to go to the depot after this and just hot everyone up and like kung fu my way in. Do you know what I mean?
What's the documentary on if you're
allowed? Yeah, no, it's about 3D printed firearms in Europe, Western Europe specifically. So in America, there's quite a big network of like kind of 3D printed gun hobbyists. about 80% of the firearms are like 3D printed. And obviously over there, it's, you know, it's a hobby, whatever. Yeah. There's more guns than people there.
Yeah.
But in obviously in Western Europe, like, that's a big deal. You know what I'm saying? So we managed to find, or at least get access to the founder of this group doing all these like 3D printed rifles and sharing the information. We met him in Western Europe and, you know, he showed us his workshop. He showed us how he builds them. And then he took us out to the forest, test fired it. Like, it's a big deal because they basically don't give a shit about who gets the technology. I was like, what if ISIS get hold of this? And they're like, oh, well, like, basically, like, you know, they're like free speech extremists, if you like, and free self-defense extremists. You know, they're not like far right or anything like that, but they're just like, we want everyone to have the ability to defend themselves against their government or whoever, which I agree with, but they've taken it to the craziest extreme of like, anyone can have a completely untraceable firearm. And they're not like, people think 3D printed guns are like these little kind of water pistol almost, oh, it'll blow up in your hands, mate. It's like it's a machine gun. Yeah. It's a semi-automatic machine gun. He makes his own ammunition. He showed us that. Like, you could go on like a murder spree with it and kill so many people. And, it's really.
And you can get 3D printers, like, they're not expensive, really.
£50 the guy made. The guy that we were filming with, he calls himself Jay Stark. His 3D printer was like £150.
Fucking hell, man.
Yeah. He had these two fucking rifles just in his workshop. And I was just like blown away by it, man. Like, and it, you know, if he gets caught, he's doing probably 10 years easily, probably more, because he's actively trying to distribute these files. Anyone can download them online, not even Darknet. It's just there on their website. Anyone can do it, you know.
But think the amount of damage that can be done on society.
Like, right.
I think this is the thing. It's very interesting talking about guns because I live in America. Although I'm living in the UK at the moment, I live in America.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've experienced it. But you have this gun culture in different countries that we don't have in the UK.
Yeah.
And it's very hard for British people to kind of get their head around gun culture in different countries. You've come across a lot in your time and experienced a lot. What's your thoughts on the British gun culture compared to the rest of the world, or even European gun culture compared to the rest of the world?
That's a good question, because it's funny. In Britain, if you say, like, I think people should be allowed to own firearms on, you know, within certain parameters, the culture we have here is, you know, like, people just go mad. They think you're a terrorist or some Nazi or whatever. So it's hard to even talk to people about it, right? Like you've kind of said, I don't want the gun culture that America has. Absolutely not. I don't want a lot of what America is trying to export here, to be honest, specifically the politics. But I do believe, you know, I'm a leftist man, like born and raised, you know, I believe that the people should have the right to defend themselves against the government. If a government can come out and shoot people, I think that the citizens should have some way to be able to defend against that should the government turn tyrannical.
Yeah.
Now people say it will never happen here. Trust me, we live in one speck of time. Anything can happen here and it can happen in our timeline. Now, saying that, where I grew up, you know, the lads that I know that have got hold of firearms, like real ones, are maniacs and criminals, and they just want to hurt people.
Yeah.
And if anybody could get a weapon, like, you know, imagine if tomorrow we had America's gun laws, right? The whole block where I live will be shot up. Yeah. People will be killing each other. I know it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, on my road, two people got stabbed this year. One was a woman. She died over a fucking parking space dispute.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I'm saying? So I don't think the guns are the issue. I think the culture is the issue. Now, just to give you one more point on that, very good thing I read once was that, like, in Iraq, you know, I've done a lot of reporting there, or a fair bit, they have something like the second or the first most unlicensed firearms, right? So loads of people have got guns, loads of people don't have licenses, who knows who the fuck has them. You can go to the market there and buy like a gold-plated AK, it's easy. However, they've had no school shootings. They had one, actually, but it was like a crazy student went in and shot his teacher over a dispute. They've had no school shootings, like rampant school shootings. America, who has way more guns than Iraq, sure, But like, you know, they have licenses and that. They have school shootings all the time.
Yeah.
So it's like you can argue, what is it, the guns or is it the culture?
Sorry to butt in there, but I also think, like, was it Iraq that you said that you could do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, like in Iraq, do they have, like, is mental health that much of an issue in Iraq, where it's,
well, it is, but it's concentrated because of the war, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah, they've got bigger things to worry about.
Yeah, exactly. Constant wars, and there is a big macho culture over there, but there's less of a, like, gangster culture. Yeah. You know, like, no one's really impressed. You know, like in the UK, we get, I call them roadman. You know, like, they're a plague man. Like, you know, I'm friends with a few of them around my way just to kind of nod at them, but they're a pain. You know, they're like, they're like, I feel sorry for them a lot of the time. They're like young boys that never grew up properly, or at least they didn't mature. And their way of being, you know, men is to be brutal and cold-hearted and overtly aggressive. That culture, I've never really experienced that in the Middle East, you know. I mean, it's there, but it manifests itself in different ways, like ISIS or whatever, you know. Yeah. So it's almost kept away a little bit. It's difficult, man. It's a funny one. It's all about culture, and I don't want there to be guns everywhere in the UK, certainly not. But I do think that as a citizen, I think it's very clear that, you know, there's one rule for us and one rule for the government, and that's not, I'm not interested in any conspiracy nonsense.
Yeah.
It's just clear, you know, if you're rich and you have, you know, you're politically powerful, you're above many laws that you and me are not.
Totally.
For example, Eric Joyce recently was found with, I think it's like called class one. It's the worst kind of child abuse images you can possibly have. He was found with that on his phone, on his computer. He didn't even go to prison. Fuck. He got a 4-year suspended sentence, which means he's out. He's just no prison time at all. Now, you know, I've got friends doing time in jail for like very small drug offenses or fist fighting. You know, so I'd argue the inequality is already there. Now, I'm not saying I want some kind of uprising or armed violence or anything, but I just do think that it's a topic worth discussing. But again, I come at it from a kind of leftist, kind of, you know, anti-state point of view, perhaps. And I understand that, like, not everybody wants that.
Yeah.
The problem with these lads with the 3D printed gun, this group called the Terrence Dispense that we filmed with, they're saying, well, fuck what you think. We think everyone should have the rights and that's that. Yeah. And I'm like, well, what if people don't want that? And they're like, we don't care. Like, you know, free, you know, the guy that we're filming, he kept saying, live free or die. And it's like, that's a very black and white way of looking at the world, man.
Does it
like,
scare you? Does it scare you?
He's one of the most scariest, dangerous people I've ever met in my life.
Really?
Believe it or not. Yeah, like just by his ideas. And he was a very likable person, you know, like off camera, we got on very well. In the doc, you'll see it. If FedEx ever delivered the hard drive, you'll see it. We had some very like heated kind of arguments. But at the same time, he was very just like, you know, he didn't mind being challenged. When he says he's a free speech kind of extremist or absolutist, he means that. He doesn't mind being challenged. He doesn't mind being argued with, which was quite refreshing. However, I kept saying to him, you know, murder is the ultimate act of removing someone's freedom.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't compute that. He was like, yeah, but we're building these guns. The Uyghurs in China can use these if they get the 3D printer. They can fight back against the tyrannical governments, which, yeah, I get that. But also, some random jihadi or some random Nazi could build this and go and shoot up a school in England or wherever, or a synagogue or, you know, or a mosque or whatever. So it's a worry, you know, but he just didn't care. He was just like, tough luck. He was like, I'm willing to sacrifice a bit of freedom, for a bit of safety for a bit more freedom. And it's like, Jay Stark, man, not everybody wants that. And he's kind of like, tough luck. You know?
Yeah, I think sometimes people don't see two sides to the story, right? And I think until they've been in the situation where their kids have been in a school where it's been shot up or something like that, you don't see two sides. You just don't see it. And it's kind of, I think there's always been these radical people in the world in everything, right? They're always, but I think with the internet and just with social media, with everything, you can kind of, you see it more often, I think, and people are allowed their opinions or speak their opinions more so because it's so easy to get to so many people.
Exactly. And imagine, so these guys have that concept, what you've just said, but with sending out schematics and blueprints and extremely detailed instructions on how to build fully working semi-automatic untraceable 3D firearms. Now, to give you an idea of how kind of wild this is, Jay Stark got some IKEA flat pack furniture like instructions and modeled his 3D printing gun instructions on them. Jeez. Like, it's like a 138 page document. I think I've got it. Anyone can get it. It's online. And it's just like, he really was like, I want people to make this. You know, I said to him, it's fair to say you're kind of trying to spread this message. He was like, oh yeah. I want people to do this. I even said to him, I said, well, look, how about this then? He said, give me some stronger arguments. I said, all right, how about someone makes this and kills someone you love? And he was like, that's a risk I have to take. And it was just like, wow, you know?
I think the thing that's going through my head, like, I live in Detroit in America. And although guns are very readily available in America, as you well know, in poorer neighborhoods and things like that, it's going to be easier to just print your own gun. And there's no trace. And then you're kind of... It's almost like it's more likely to be used not against the government, but against their own people, your own people. And,
exactly.
And I think that's when you start kind of creating civil wars. And I don't necessarily agree with how all governments are run their countries and everything like that. I think that's a completely different debate.
Mm.
But I also don't think violence necessarily is always the way to overcome that. I think in situations you need to, and it does have to happen, and you've proven that in your work, if you know what I mean, that sometimes you have to, because it's the last chance. However, in a situation, let's say for instance the UK, like, I think that would just fuck everything up.
We don't need it, man. No. We're not like, I mean, our government is becoming increasingly more authoritarian by the week. I keep a very close eye on this. I mean, I'm not really interested in all these isms and schisms. Ultimately, my political ideology is just anti-authoritarian, whether that's from the left, from the right, or the center, or wherever. I am very much against that. So I keep a close eye on it. Like, Big Brother Watch is a good resource for people that want to do that.
Okay.
A lot of it goes completely unreported. It goes under the radar. Very strange bits of policy that are quite hard to understand. It's happening in our country. Our country is becoming increasingly more authoritarian. Europe is. France have just brought in an insane bill they want to pass where they want to limit how people can film the police. In any free society, people should be able to film the police when they're on duty as much as they want, I believe, you know, just to make sure they don't do anything insane like we're seeing all the time, like killing black people in America in an insane, disproportionate amount.
Yeah.
So there is that, right? However, we are not being put into gulags. We are not living like China. We are, you know what I mean? Like, we're not the Uyghurs. We're not like the Kurds in Turkey. We're not being oppressed to that level yet. I very much doubt that will ever happen here.
Yeah.
But there's levels to it, is what I'm saying.
And there's a balance, right?
Yeah. Like, we don't need to go and shoot up Parliament yet. You know what I mean?
No.
For Christ's sake.
And hopefully we never have to get to that point. Yeah. And I think. I've been watching a lot of your stuff recently over the last couple of weeks. In fact, one of my good friends from America, she sent me a podcast you did on QAnon.
With
the guys, and I listened to that. And I was like, I need to kind of check you out. And you kind of have. I'm not a huge fan of looking at news and look. I don't agree with mainstream media. I don't think it's healthy. I think everything's politically kind of charged, depending on who that media outlet kind of decides to support. And I think there's so much in the world that we're not taught about and we're not learnt. That's not great English, but we're just like,
oh, well, I'm a shitbag. Don't worry about it. I know what you're saying.
We're just not. I think it's whatever they want you to know, they're trying to kind of push it, if you know what I mean. Classic example, COVID at this moment in time, and the whole world has been kind of screwed over by this thing. But there's still so many more things that are happening in this world that are so much more important than COVID. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, anybody that's lost their lives to COVID or anything like that. It's an awful thing. However, there's places in the world that are going through a lot worse things. And I really like what you've done on your platform, Popular Front. Why did you start it? How did it all start?
Well, it kind of ties into what you've just said about like mainstream. And I'm not like, I don't hate mainstream media. Like I made my place in mainstream media. I worked for Vice News for like 5 years when it was really good at the start. I'm not saying that like because I was there. I just happened to be there at that time. You know what I'm saying? And it was like an amazing place. And, you know, I've worked for The Guardian. I'm doing bits for the BBC. But there is a big problem within mainstream media right now. You're right, I think. And it's very much, there's no insidious kind of Soros or whatever the hell it is at the top, like being like, do this, do that. It's just the culture wars. I think, unfortunately, mostly from America being exported to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And we're just seeing, you know, I've had people before I started Popular Front, they're like, you know, I was like, I want to cover this underreported conflict that nobody knows about. It's really interesting. The world should know. And they're like, what's the angle? I'm like, there isn't an angle. People should know and it will be interesting. How can we link it to Trump? And unfortunately, like short-sighted commissioning editors who have pressure from their superiors to get views and get clicks. I understand it's a whole machine and not one person can kind of, you know, change it at the moment, unfortunately. Again, it's not some conspiracy, but it's just a mess. And it's just focused on, you know, how can we kind of rile up attention, essentially. Anger at the minute online very much causes a lot of attention, causes a lot of clicks and traffic. For example, a guy I know, Darius, a very good journalist, works for Channel 4 as a freelancer. And, you know, I'm not putting him in it here. He said it openly and publicly online. He wanted to do a piece about Shusha, this city that had been overrun in Nagorno-Karabakh, that place between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They just finished the war there. There's been a brutal war going on for 2 months. The Azerbaijanis have been beheading people on camera, like filming it, tearing off people's ears, murdering civilians, executing people. And he wanted to do a piece saying, look what they're doing. And they were going to run it. They only wanted a 2-minute piece. This is Channel 4 News, which are kind of left leaning and you would think more open minded.
Yeah.
And they bumped it because some guy that works for the FA said something vaguely racist on Twitter. Now, obviously, we need to bring attention to racists because fuck them. But at the same time, like, are you really going to, you're going to move off a horrific war crimes in favor of going, oh, look, someone said something racist on Twitter again.
Yeah.
Like, it's so ridiculous, you know, and that's the problem. It's attention. Honestly, a lot of it is like a lot of people at the top of media, despite them kind of window dressing with more ethnic people. The problem is it's like very entitled, rich white middle class people who have the kind of commissioning editor roles still, and until they actually put people from different backgrounds in them higher up roles, a lot of it is not going to change. You can't just go, we've got 15 black or Asian hosts, it's okay now. No, why are they just the hosts? why aren't they in the positions? They can do it exactly they can do it better than you can because they have a different life experience, right? And I'm not on some woke bullshit, I'm not about that, but it's just the truth. So anyway, to answer your question, sorry, about why I started Popular Front, it was a disillusionment with mainstream media. And, you know, I've been covering war and conflict since I was 24. I'm 30 now. And in the last 3 years, I just saw it getting worse and worse. People weren't interested. When I would do a piece, they would cut it, make it small. They would not focus on the very intricate details of what tell you the most about war. So I said, you know what, fuck this. I'm going to start my own thing. We have no corporate backing. We refuse corporate adverts. Like we got like over 1 million unique downloads with no advertising whatsoever. You know, we're doing okay. It's blowing up. We got a piece featured in the Times today, like the biggest broadsheet newspaper in UK. We're doing well. And we've had no help from venture capital, nothing. We run it all via Patreon and merchandise and donations. And I want to keep it like that. You know, people say, oh, it's an anti-capitalist thing. It's not really. It's just an anti-corporate bullshit.
Yeah.
We don't want that. The ethos is, it is like it is. Be honest about our biases. I've always said that. People say, oh, objective, objective. You can't cover war completely objectively because it makes you cold and a psycho. If you see a child, I've seen children with like shrapnel in their necks and stuff, and they can't go to a hospital because the military will arrest them for being terrorists, even though they just got caught in a war. there is a part of you that has to just go, that's really bad. And one side here is being a lot worse. You know what I'm saying? Like the majority of the war crimes footage coming from the Karabakh war is from Azerbaijan. The government in Azerbaijan rewarded a man a few years ago who hacked a Armenian soldier to death with an axe in Europe on a peace meeting. You know, they rewarded him. He's now a hero in their country. Now, I'm not saying Armenians are chill. Like, they have done a few ear cuttings recently. It's not good. It's disgusting. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Jesus. But there is a vast majority of the war crimes are on their side. Mm. So people are saying, you're biased to Armenia. You love Armenia. It's like, well, actually, we're showing you what's happening and we're saying this is fucking terrible.
Yeah.
And if you think that's biased, that's on you. But like, we're not going to sugarcoat it. For an example, BBC ran a whole report and they stayed so objective that the only line they had about the multiple, I've seen 12 beheadings and ear cuttings, I think now, videos, they said the line was, there are allegations of war crimes on both sides. There are videos on Telegram every day of Azeri soldiers cutting off heads and holding them. There was one yesterday where they cut a man's head off and placed it on a dead pig and kicked it. Like, how can you not report that?
Yeah.
How can you not go into the detail of that? I think there needs to be some feeling and outrage within media. I think some people need to be held account and on a kind of almost vicious way. When they're doing vicious stuff, you have to viciously report on that. And if it's horrible for you to see, tough luck. I believe if you're living in peace, you have to be aware of the people that aren't, you know?
I totally agree. Because I think this is why I like what you do, is because I didn't know half the fucking stuff that was going on in the world. Mate, and like, it's completely my fault for not researching it, right? But I'll be honest with you, I have a great life. I've got things to do, and I don't want to spend half my day trying to work out what's going on with the Armenians, if you know what I mean. And I don't mean that in a selfish way. But what your platform does is gives me this information that I need to know that mainstream media is not telling me. I was watching the China protests and riots videos that you guys did
in Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong. Yeah. China, yeah. And I was just like, you see what the BBC tells you, and then you see what's actually happening on the ground. How long does it take you to kind of get to these places and like actually be allowed to go into these places and kind of report? Because it's not easy. Just, I can't imagine it being just get on a plane and rock up with a camera.
No, I mean, firstly, just for answer that question, I will say like BBC and a lot of people do very good reporting. Like, there are some incredible war reporters there, like Quentin Somerville, excellent war reporter. But the problem is they don't get enough airtime.
No, that's what I mean. What I mean. Like, I know there's good people. I've got friends that work in the BBC as well, and they're great. But it is, we want to sugarcoat everything. We want to be careful with everything we say.
Exactly.
And that's not how I am. That's not how we are as people, right? We want to just be told it.
That's not how most people are. Yeah. This is, again, comes back to, I think it's, I don't want to rant on about politics, but a lot of it is a class issue. There's a certain temperament that people within mainstream media have, or big media, I would call it. And their temperament is often very different to the people that consume the news, actually. Yeah. And the temperament of people that consume it are ready to be given the reality. They're not stupid. There's this horrible idea within media that like people are kind of stupid or they don't have attention spans. It's not true. No. It's not true. People will binge watch 8 hours on Netflix. It's just not true. But you have to give them in a way they want to absorb it. So to answer your question, like the way I get into these places, now it's a lot easier because I've got like, you know, like a solid 7 years. I got good work. I've made mistakes here and there, but there's been no huge fuck ups on my part, you know. And I think people trust me. I go into a lot of detail. I'm not scared to go to the front and say, this is bad. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, as a lot of war reporters are not, you know, there's some amazing war reporters out there. But I think for us, we have a lot of trust now with people where it's like, look, I'm going to cut. And I'm always honest. You know, with the 3D printed gun thing, I said to them, look, I don't agree with what you're doing. Straight up. I don't think it's good. I understand. And like, I get on with you guys, you know, on a personal basis, we get on fine. We have a similar culture or background or entertainment things we're both interested in, but I don't agree and I don't think it's good and I'm not going to do an advert for you. And they were like, all right, cool. And you know, and the guy who I made the doc, he had to see it before I put it out only, I don't normally do that, but just because of security purposes, I have to protect my source, totally. Even if I don't like him or agree with him, you know. And he was like, well, I don't like the way you did this, but fair enough. And it's like, well, there you go, bro. Like, yeah. That's how it is. So I think people know we're not going to fuck them. Like, I, you know, like people always say, I'm too pro-Kurdish, too pro-YPG. And I've said to the Kurds and that, I said, you do a war crime, I'm telling everyone. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if I see it, I'm doing it. I'm showing you. So it's one of them ones where I think for Popular Front, it's an alternative for people, because we do get stuck in, like, you know, our documentary that we did with the Hong Kong protesters, like you mentioned, we focus specifically on the frontliners.
Yeah.
People can, you know, they slur us and they say, oh, it's riot porn. It's like, well, there are about 4 or 5 very detailed interviews with these kids. You find out things about them that no one else was doing, really. Like, we got stuck in with them. We went and we saw their safe house. You know, we were with them the whole way. And there is a part of people that are in conflict. When they see you shoulder to shoulder to them, it's not macho. It's like, I'm there to be like, hey, I want to experience what's going on here to fully understand it, you know? And you can do that in a, I guess, away from the action, but I think you do need to be involved in the action to a degree, because there are things on a front line that, if you're observant, will tell you things that you didn't realize.
Totally.
Like, even the way people look at each other, perhaps as they're communicating, you can see, ah, there's a power dynamic here that they're perhaps not being honest about on their propaganda. You know, like in Syria with the YPG and the Kurds, the way they present what they're doing is a lot different to the way it is on the ground. You know, yeah. I mean, they're not like bad guys or anything, but there's obviously a very strict hierarchy of power within the military because they're at war. They have to.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot of problems within this kind of left libertarian utopia they're trying to build, which they don't often tell you about. So it's important to be right next to it, I think. And we do that by just being honest, I think. And we get on, like, the people I have on my team, like, I have people that I trust, you know, like, and I have people that I know can communicate with people. They're not turning. I've seen reporters turn up and you can just feel the presence of them is the big I am. They're with their team.
Yeah.
And they kind of turn it on when the camera's on. And when the camera's off, they're like, see ya. And they go back to the hotel. We don't do that, man. We eat with them. We stay where they're staying. We smoke their cigarettes. We drink their tea, which sounds, I don't mean that in like some kind of like white savior guy, like with Lawrence of Arabia. People out there don't see it like that anyway. That's just some diaspora bullshit. But, you know, they appreciate you being there and they yeah. appreciate that, like, we're interested in their lives. It's not just like the action. It's like, I want to go to the front line because I know how their lives are going to be affected by having to go there.
Yeah.
That to me is way more interesting than a bit of bang, bang. Sure, there's an excitement to that. I'm not going to lie. It's very uplifting in a very fucked up way. You know, there's a very weird thing about being on the front line where you realize your problems don't perhaps matter.
Yeah.
So that can be addictive in a way, but also the most addictive thing for me is just being around these people in surreal parts of the world, in surreal environments, and just seeing how they like survive and cope despite all their tragedies happening and all the oppression. And I just find that so interesting. And I think it's important to report that up close, you know, and I'll never change it. And people, like, we've got a big fan base. A lot of people love what we do and a lot of people don't like what we do. And that's okay. I say, look, it's not all for you. Like, it's not, Popular Front isn't for everyone. Media should stop trying to be for everyone. You know?
Totally.
It should be for, we're very niche and it is what it is, you know?
It's niche, but I don't think it's not what I was saying about me, about more so the mainstream media. It doesn't feel like you have agendas going in, like political agendas or anything like that. And I think that's what I struggle with mainstream media or social media and things like that. It's always politically agendarized, if that is a such word. And yeah. It just feels like you're just telling how it is. Because I watched your Chop documentary last night. About Chaz. Did you go there or was that somebody else that was...
I can't go to America, unfortunately. It's my stupid court case in Turkey.
Okay.
Which is ongoing still. I mean, I could, but it's a very, very long process to go.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, I'd need to pay an immigration lawyer a fortune to get it sorted. But no, I didn't go there. But I had two guys, like very cool guys, like a little team. They were like, hey, man, we want to make this for you. Honestly, at first, I was like, fuck the Chaz, fuck the Chop. It looks like a white liberal powwow, you know, like, oh, blah, blah. But I think the most interesting element, once they started showing me the footage they filmed, was there was this disconnect, you know, where the black community, you see it in our doc, right? They're saying, like, we appreciate you being here for us, but you need to let us speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, when a lot of white anarchists start destroying a shop, like, you know, I'm not against vandalism. I think who gives a fuck if it's not an independent business and it's a part of the process. You know, I don't agree with it, but whatever.
Yeah.
It gives a fuck. But when they start doing that and then the black community is left behind and they start getting kind of more scrutinized by these right-wing media pundits in the US, they're kind of like, look, you've made us look really bad here. Like, you know what I mean? You came to help and you did a lot of damage in a way. And I think there's a lot of people in the CHOP documentary who are very interesting and very honest. You know, there's a good dynamic between the black community there and the white people trying to help them. And I believe in solidarity and unity between people. And I don't believe in any of this stupid woke nonsense, but you have to listen to the people that are in the most problematic situations, right?
Totally.
CHOP had a very strange dynamic there, as you see at the end when a load of people got killed.
Dude, so when I watched it, I'm still unsure about it. I'll be honest.
Yeah, good. And you should be. Like, because there was no answer in it, right? There
yeah.
was
no answer. And like before going into it, I was like, this is going to agree with what I have in my head, that this is just a load of bullshit and that this is extremely leftist and people kind of taking advantage of the kind of black people and Black Lives Matter kind of movement and things like that. But it kind of did completely the opposite. And
that's interesting. How so?
Because I didn't know that much about it, if I'm totally honest with you. And I had this thing that it was people took over the streets, or a group of people took over the streets and was almost running it how America is being ran, but they're just doing it themselves. And And I thought that's what it was. And it was to a certain extent, if you know what I mean. Like, if people, I completely disagree with police brutality, I'm pretty sure that 99% of this world disagrees with that. But then when you've got people guarding with guns and also shooting at people, that's, you're just doing that exact same thing as what the police are doing. So does that make you better or the same?
Here's where I differ with you on that. I know what you mean, but so first of all, I had a lot of respect for, so you see in the documentary, there's like white leftists.
Yeah.
And I know some of the groups, like the John Brown Gun Club.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
not particularly hyper-political.
Yeah.
They're just like, we're white working class. Anyone can join, but yeah, they're mainly a white working class armed group that believe in, you know, being self-defense. And their argument is, in a country full of guns and police killing black people and in an improportional way, and we know a load of black people are out here, they went there and there was a lot of right wingers were turning up, like Proud Boy guys and those fucking freaks. And there was even some like actual Nazi groups kind of hanging around. So I kind of had respect for them. They were like, yeah, like, we're going to put our lives on the line and say, yeah, we'll defend our black brothers and sisters. However, like you said, it then became a problem. There was also a gang element where some kind of gang members from the area got involved.
Yeah.
And then it became like, well, these guys are not like trying to protect the people. They're trying to assert dominance, as you've said, which again, exactly what the police are doing. That's the problem. It didn't have enough structure. People think that anarchism, for example, which was a kind of quite a strong element there, or at least people think it was. Anarchism doesn't mean complete. It's not the dictionary definition of the word anarchy.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like freedom, but with order. But I think a lot of people there were like, no rules. It's like, you can't just have no rules.
No.
You know what I mean? It's like, abolish the police. It's like, if you actually mean never have any policing of the community is never going to be safe.
Yeah.
You know, like, who are you going to call the fucking socialist book club if your sister gets kidnapped? Like, you need people that can protect the community. Now, I have a very big issue with the police that I don't want to go into too much. I have a very big problems with the way they do their stuff. But I'm not against policing. You know, in Rojava, for example, in Kurdistan, northeast Syria, they have loads of police. They're meant to be, you know, they come to Asayish. They're kind of a security force for the people. Yeah. Now, even them, a few of them are getting a little bit too police-like, and people will tell you that. But generally, they're trying to protect the people from fucking ISIS, or they're trying to make, because a big part of their ideology is female equality. So if they find out that there's people in the area that, obviously in Syria, that's not a big, people don't like female equality very much. No. So if they find out that there's like some guy beating his wife, they'll go in and sort it out. That has to be done.
Yeah, totally.
You know, there are certain rules that have to be implemented, yeah. You know, for freedom, for people to be free.
Yeah.
Without rules, anyone can oppose themselves on other people. And that's the opposite of anarchism or leftism, in my opinion. So you actually like hit the nail on the head there, I think. Like, I know that's a very weird way of going around.
No, man, I get it.
The way it developed, you're right. It turned into like gangs trying to be the police. And to be honest, a lot of the like leftist armed groups that I spoke to agreed, you know, off camera perhaps, or like in personal messages. They kind of were like, we just left after a while. We realized that it was becoming a gang element. People were trying to tell people, you can't do this here.
Yeah.
And it kind of became, not in a protective way. It became in a way of like, this is our domain. We can sell our drugs here. And it's like, come on, man. You're creating lawlessness. You're not creating equality and, you know, shared libertarianism. You're just fucking people up.
You're just going backwards in life, right? It's not, there's no progression. There's no movement forward into the future. It's just, you're almost going back to how America used to be back in the mob days when the police weren't around or they were just getting paid off. And I think it's kind of gone to the other extreme now where they feel like they own the country. But the thing is, and this is kind of an unpopular opinion, and I know people were probably going to give me shit for saying this, but
red flag.
Yeah. Hands cold. No, just watch out. But we only see the bad bits of the police, right? We're only ever going to be showed that the bad bits shouldn't happen. They 100% shouldn't happen. But for me, is what I've been trying to work out during this whole time is, how do you get the bad out of these forces that you don't, that shouldn't be there? How do you get that? Because you put 100 people in a room, guaranteed a few of them are going to be dickheads. And you give that percentage a gun, or you give that percentage a taser, they're going to use it.
Mm.
So how, I don't know how, but I don't know if you have an answer.
I don't have an answer. Like, I'm, you know, a lot of leftists very much hate me because of, they were saying, oh, you're such a fucking nihilist, whatever. I don't care about those labels. But there is no revolution. No. There is no revolution never coming. The power that is there, I'm really annoying myself because I'm sounding so political, but you get my point. There's nothing going to happen, man. What, you think police can reform themselves? Like, no.
No.
Like, what? It's not going to happen, man. There's no revolution coming. The utopia is never going to happen. At the end of the day, life is imperfect, and I think you just got to kind of try and live the way you can within your own beliefs. And if we can help people out, you know, we can help them out. I mean, a weird example that just came into my head is there's like, you know, Big Issue, right, in the UK, where that charity that helps homeless people, they take a lot of money themselves, actually. There's a better group that I know called, they call themselves DOPE. It stands for something. It's not about drugs.
Yeah.
And like what they're doing is amazing. They're just like, giving they're not even non-profit, they're anti-profit, they won't take profit, and they help these homeless people. And you know, I've had discussions with them and talking about like, you know, and they're kind of anarchists and whatever, and they just said like, I don't know what we are, who gives a fuck, we're helping people. Yeah, we're helping homeless people, like that's what we do. And it's like, yeah man, like maybe step off Twitter and go and, you know, volunteer at the soup kitchen or go and help someone out. That is, you know, a real community effort. And actually, there's a big bad rap because a lot of the Twitter bubble is just that. It's a very small bubble. Something like 22% of America is on Twitter. It's essentially inconsequential in the larger scheme of things.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh. I shit on a lot of American leftists, but I know a lot of them doing very good work. They don't talk about it. They don't put it on Twitter, and they're not having beefs over who said what bad word. You know, they're doing the work. They're helping people. And that's all we can do, I think, you know. And I don't think that should be particularly like brutally political either. You know, like certain people will be, you know, I saw something where there was some like steel worker that was a Trump supporter. I mean, fuck Trump. But at the end of the day, I think his business went out, you know, he was fucked. He was destitute because of the situation of COVID. And I saw people like, ha ha, tough shit MAGA supporter.
Yeah, fuck.
It's like, come on, man. Like, really? Like, he lives in some rust belt. Like, again, the world is made up of imperfect people. And just what I think is good for people doesn't mean it's right. You know, I'm not saying what I think is right. I think it's right in my own self. But I'm not going to tell you that, like, oh, you should fucking die because of this. Obviously, they're an example, different, you know, racists. I despise them. Fascists. I despise them. I don't care about what happens to them. But you know what I'm saying? There are levels to it.
But you wouldn't be going online asking people to kill them, right?
No, like, fuck it.
Like come on.
I mean, look, my opinion is, you know, I did a lot of reporting on an armed Nazi group in the US called Atomwaffen over the last 2 years. They were planning terror attacks. They were trying to kill people. They killed people. They killed 5 people. I mean, if they want to do that, they want to take your freedom away. Self-defense.
Fuck them.
Why not? Yeah. Like, maybe, you know, if a Nazi comes to my door, I'm not going to shake their hand, put it that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is an element where I'm not saying they should be killed, but if they want to kill you, what are you going to do? Let it happen? No. However, this whole idea of, like, you're MAGA, you should die. It's like, really? Like, we're living in a small space of time here. We don't need to be calling for the death of everybody based on stuff like that, you know? I mean, what about all these despotic regimes that America is and will continue exporting arms and money to?
Exactly.
More focused on that, I would argue, but that's me. That's what I think. But
what's your thoughts on the whole the word Nazi? Because you've done a lot of kind of reporting with regimes that are against neo-Nazis, and also, like you said, the Nazi group in America. Like, it gets thrown around so much.
It gets thrown around so much that it's almost become like a phantom of a word. Now, my problem is, as well, this thing of fascism as well. Like, I've done a lot of... I sound like big brain meme now, but, like, you know, I've done a lot of reading on fascism and fucking left and post-left and far-right. And just my interest. I've always been interested in it. So it annoys me when someone goes, that guy's a fascist. It's like... Well, you know, fascism is a very specific ideology.
Yeah.
He might be right-wing, he might be far-right, and he might be a horrific authoritarian, but that doesn't always mean fascist. Now, that's not to excuse fascists, fuck them. I just think in terms of language, you have to be correct. You have to be correct with things. If someone is a racist, he might not necessarily be a Nazi. You know, to be a Nazi, you have to believe in National Socialism. A racist and a Nazi is as bad, it's disgusting to me. It's the same thing
in
how horrific it is. But we must be correct in our speech. If you just say he's a Nazi and you throw that around, well, then what else can then start getting thrown around without the full meaning of it? You know what I'm saying? It's like, I really just think you have to be specific, because these words have long histories of violence and meaning behind them. So to properly investigate them and stop them, we have to be very specific on what they believe.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they just get all mixed up in a weird milieu and they can just start shifting out. They can just start escaping. You have to say, no, that's the Francoist section of this fascist group. They're the Nazis. They're the Nazi bowls. Believe it or not, there's like a far-right Bolshevik group. You know, like, I think you have to be very specific, because they are. they define themselves very specifically on these stupid niche right-wing ideologies that they have. So if they're doing it, that's the way they characterize themselves. To build a map, which me and my friends have done, I have a team where we research all these Nazi movements and fascist and white supremacist movements. You have to be very specific on like what they're doing to map them out, to find out where they might go next. For example, the Proud Boys. I mean, they're a bunch of fucking losers, but I don't think they're Nazis. They're like, they're American nationalists. Yeah. Like that, like that wouldn't be Nazism, because that would mean they want, they're like hyper-capitalist, like right, far right guys.
Yeah.
A Nazi would want National Socialism, okay, which is completely different to what Trump is doing. So yeah, why would they be pro-Trump if the actual Nazis, for example, Atomwaffen, hate Trump?
Yeah.
Because he's against, they don't mind right-wing shit, but they just, it's not their ideology. So to understand them, we have to be very specific, I think. So yeah, throwing the word Nazi around at everything you don't like is like, you know, I saw this crazy researcher refer to me once as a Nazi because I said that podcast Come Town. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
No.
It's just like a very stupid, immature podcast. And I was, you know, I was like, it's pretty funny sometimes.
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
she called the guy like a Nazi and said that I'm like a Nazi adjacent. Like, luckily, a load of people came to my defense. Was like, this guy's fucking like tracked a fucking Nazi terrorist group for the last 3 years. Like, what the fuck? But you know what I mean? Like, when people can start doing that to people that are clearly not Nazis, it destroys the meaning of the word. And then you have to remember, brave young men and women fought and fucking died to stop Nazis. So to just throw that word around empty without thinking of all that, I think is irresponsible.
I
understand why they do it, but it's irresponsible.
One of my best mates, it comes from a Jewish family. And I remember like a couple of summers, he lives in LA, a couple of summers ago, he like just took his t-shirt off or something. And he's got a tattoo with the Star of David. And I was like, dude, what's that number for? And he was like, that was my granddad's number in the concentration camps. And I was like, that was literally like two generations ago. And then now, two generations later, people are throwing around this word almost like it has no power to it.
Yes.
And I think
words have power and meaning, right?
They do, man. And I think people forget that.
Mm.
That it was literally 80, not even 80 years ago, when the world was at war, millions of people died. Yesterday,
basically, in the time.
It was nothing. It was like a blip.
Yeah, I met one of the first things I ever did. I met with a Holocaust survivor. I think she lived the longest time in Auschwitz. Somehow she survived for like 2 years or some shit.
Damn.
It was a very long time ago. I forget how exactly she swerved all that. But and it was just like, I remember just thinking like, she was in a concentration camp. Like, she's alive. Like, it's so brutal. And there are concentration camps now, you know, like in China right now, the Uyghur Muslims are put in concentration camps. I mean, there's a lot of very, we call them tankies, like hardline communists that are pro-Stalin that say they're not concentration camps. They are by every stretch of the word, they are. And it's just like, you know, what happened to never again? And again, like, my point is, if you start like throwing words around that have a very serious history behind them where they shouldn't be used, it does dilute it. The biggest problem, right, is this happened to me a while ago, like a couple of years ago when the woke culture wars were really high. Before, someone say, this guy's a Nazi, I'd be like, whoa, fuck, what? Let me look at this as a Nazi. What's he doing? Let me find out. And it got to the point where I was like, oh, that guy's not a Nazi. He's just like a fucking prick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Gavin McInnes, like he's a fucking dickhead. He's not Nazi. Like, you know, I think he's a white supremacist probably, but he's not a Nazi. He's not a National Socialist.
Yeah.
He's fucking up Trump's ass. So it got to the point where I was just like, I would just tune out.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, again, is it Nazi being thrown around again? Just couldn't even be bothered. That's very dangerous.
It is.
I'm like that. I'm a fucking lunatic. Like, I'm really into like, you know, hardcore shit. Imagine what like a guy just trying to get by and like find out a little bit about the world is going to do when he sees that. He's going to be like, what? They're not Nazis. Like, he's just going to tune out. And it's too much noise. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The more noise doesn't mean more listening. It actually does the opposite. It just turns you off, you know?
How did we get to the point in where we are nowadays with concentration camps happening in China?
That's a great question. One I don't really know the answer to, but
have you done any research? Or I'm sure you have, but in China or how? Because I don't have a fucking clue. Like,
so China is, you know, I mean, China, it's the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. But again, this is another word that's lost meaning, right? And I'm not a communist. I have communist friends, but we argue. I'm like, I think your ideology is fucking stupid. I don't like any statism, but whatever. Communism is whatever. It's not this big evil. Stalinism is the big evil. The Soviet Union was fucking disgraceful. But the idea of just communism on itself is whatever.
Yeah.
So again, this word has lost its meaning. So people say, oh, you know, there's a communist state. China is communist in no way possible, you know, like they're a state, hyper state capitalism. It's an authoritarian like state, and they have the guise of communism, and they certainly use a lot of the basis of communist ideas, but it's its own behemoth now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's beyond the realm of just communism. It's just this brutally authoritarian state, but it's incredibly powerful. A lot of money goes through there, and it's beneficial for a lot of Western countries to have good trade deals there. You know, all of our shit, everything we're using right now has probably been made in China.
Exactly.
You know, unfortunately, money speaks more than oppression, and people will just say, hey, fuck it. You know, I mean, look at the UN. The UN delivers a little statement. The UN is deeply concerned. Just Google that one time. Google NATO. Deeply concerned, or UN deeply concerned. See how concerned they are. They're very concerned, but they've been very concerned for a long time. Now, I'm not arguing that they should just invade every country and start murdering people, but I think the problem is, or at least the thing that to understand this question you've asked me is to understand that these big safeguarding, I don't know what you would call them, institutions like NATO, UN, all of that, EU. It's not, they're not moral institutions.
No.
And I think that's where people trip up, you know. They don't have morals, they have values, but they will just shit on those values when they want. This week, the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, right? They had a tweet and they were bragging, we've been on a joint operation with our partner NATO, our NATO partner Turkey. Turkey, the second biggest jailer of journalists. In the world, you know, you can go to prison for a tweet in Turkey. They have got away with war crimes. Like, there is footage of NATO Turkish soldiers executing prisoners of war and kicking them off a mountain that has been verified, and it came out 3 years ago.
Wait, NATO. Say that again.
So there's a video of like Turkish soldiers executing two female militants, Kurdish militants. They shoot them and kick them off of a mountain. It's verified. And
is that NATO?
Yeah, they're NATO's second largest army. NATO didn't even release a deeply concerned statement. They didn't even acknowledge it. So when that happens, and then our country is saying, we're with our NATO partner, you do have to ask, when you look a bit deeper, well, what do we stand for? What does it actually stand for? Now, I get that you can't just go, fuck you, Turkey, like, because, you know, that's my immature way of dealing with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But thank God I don't run NATO, you know, like, thank God I don't run the world. I'm a fucking shithead. But at the end of the day, you do have to look at these things and say, well, they're not a moral, you know, they're diplomatic, but they're not a moral organization. And that's how it's happened. You know, never again happened. Never again, never again. Well, it's happening.
Yeah,
it's already happening. We've got concentration camps in a time when people that were in concentration camps are still alive.
Yeah.
What happened in Myanmar when they massacred all the Muslims? Like, and then you've got like, there's a big onslaught of like anti-Jewish sentiment now that is raising within the left. And it's just like this idea that these kind of institutions are something you should put moral trust in, I just think is misguided. You know, I really, for me, a lot of it came to a head when like the Brexit thing happened. I wanted to stay in the EU just because I was like, it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But
then I was walking down the road and seeing motherfuckers flying EU flags outside their house. Like, what? Like, your pride in the EU, it's like within our values, within our morals, it's the European morals. Like, all right, what about the horrific corruption that the EU is involved in Africa? You know, like, what about that? Like, is that our values? I don't know. No icons, I think. Fuck the icons, bro. Like, just, you know what I'm saying?
I totally agree. I think with the whole EU thing, that it's kind of scary leaving the EU, because what the EU was set up for after after World War II and everything like that. And you're just kind of like, it's not good to have teams to a certain extent, because, or sides or anything like that. However, when something's been set up, in the grand scheme of things, it's a safety barrier, where to kind of prevent war at the end of the day within each other. Obviously, that's not the only reason. It's not the only reason, but I think
how much do we prevent the war?
Exactly, I mean, and this is the argument against it. Is that
it's not happening next door, but it's happening for other motherfuckers big time,
and we're jumping in on
it. We're not helping them.
We're jumping in on it. America's sending all the arms over there. England sending troops over. What's your thoughts on the whole wars in Iraq and Afghan and fighting against ISIS and everything like that? What do you think? It's good that we send troops and we do all of this. Do you think it's actually made a difference? You've been on the ground there. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I know friends that have been in the army that have been on the ground, but they're very polarized on, yes, war should have happened or war shouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Soldiers are different. You know, I've got a few friends that are soldiers and we have a very big disagreements, you know, and it's good, like good friends, not falling out.
Yeah.
But you have to understand, like, there's a big difference between someone that has gone to fight for their country in a different country to me, who observes it. I've never shot a rifle in my life. I'm not interested in the army as a, you know, I never want to be a soldier or anything like that. So I do have a different perspective. I get what you're saying. It's a hard question, man, because look, ISIS was essentially like the Nazism of our generation in a way, you know, what they were doing. I mean, they're hardcore, that you talk about fascism, like the ideology of ISIS is pure fascism, Islamist fascism, but no less fascism, you know. Literally, even to the point, I mean, to the point where their political structure is set up like that, you know what I mean? It's a form of fascism, I could argue. So it's one of these ones where we caused, and by we, I mean like Britain and the West, caused so much problems in the Middle East that I think when ISIS cropped up, it would have been very bad to just go, we're out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, once you kind of, you know, put your dick in the kind of beehive, you have to deal with it a little bit. You know what I'm saying? So I think that what we did was good on many levels. So I hate saying we because I'm not a nationalist or anything, but you know what I mean? For example, the Kurds is a good example. Like, you know, they were fighting tooth and nail as they were just getting massacred by ISIS. And America and Britain and France, to a lesser degree, but mostly America, went in and started helping them with airstrikes. Now, if those guys didn't come and do the airstrikes, they would have been gone. They would have been wiped out. They fought very tough, but they would have been gone. Now, there's a lot of the very funny thing comes in here where, like, a lot of hardline communists online are like, fuck the Kurds. Because the Kurds, like the YPG, is a left libertarian movement. They used to be communist, but they stopped that in 1998. They have a new ideology now. They call it democratic confederalism. It's quite interesting. Anyway, so a lot of these hardline communists are like, wow, they're letting the imperialists in. And I'm like, what? So to keep you, internet communist, happy, they should have gone, well, we better just die. You know what I mean? Let's just die. Let's just be killed. Sorry, America. You know, so there's a lot of weird kind of strange battlefield kind of, I don't know, you help me, I'll help you situations that happened. And certainly with the help of England and America and France, the Kurds basically took out ISIS in their main stronghold in Iraq. You know, they don't hold ground like they did. That's very good. And I think it was good that we helped them because essentially their values are what we allegedly stand for, you know, like equality for races and religions, you know, anti chopping off heads, you know, that's bad, obviously. So I think in that sense, it's very black and white. Like you stop the people that are massacring and taking sex slaves, you stop them. However, then you could say, well, oh, what, you're pro-interventionists. And I could, you know, maybe I'm a hypocrite in that sense. You know, I think you have to accept that things are not black and white. I don't think there's a specific answer. It's like on some cases, I think, we murdered and slaughtered our way through history. We had the empire. Now we have the best weapons. I think we kind of have an obligation to go and help the people that we fucked up when they're trying to do whatever. But at the same time, where does that end? You know, like, we got rid of Saddam. Obviously, Saddam was a piece of shit, you know, like, you just read about what people did under his regime, you know, like drilling people in the knees for nothing was a big thing. So that's good that he's gone. But then,
but is it?
I'm an absolutist in that. I think even if life is worse or harder economically, dictators should always be gone. And I'm not saying I'm right. And the people would argue with me on the ground there saying we should have still have Saddam. And
no, I respect your opinion, man.
I can't argue with them because they live there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's just my opinion. Yeah. However, look what we did in Afghanistan. We fought in Afghanistan. And then I was reading this great book recently where, you know, they brought in this thing, Democracy in a Box, right? So they brought in Karzai and they brought in this other guy. And some of the ballots, there was like 200% attendance. There's 200, you know, like, which doesn't exist. It wasn't in meaning from the town. It was like there's 200%. And there was towns where like more people voted than people that lived in the town. It was really corrupt. It was completely fucking fraudulent. The NATO and the UN were told, they were presented with evidence. This isn't conspiracy. It's well documented by very good journalists. And they just kind of ignored it anyway. I'm like, fuck it. We have to have this guy. So it's like, did you deliver them democracy?
Yeah, that's not democracy, is it?
Yeah, it's like, did you just give them a guy that was useful because you know, and we're still in Afghanistan. Like, you know, so there is no answer, because then you could say, well, there's a thing in Somalia right now where I think America is saying, let's just pull all our elitist troops out. And a lot of the Somalians are saying, please fucking don't, because then Al-Shabaab or whichever the most militant Islamist group is there now, they're like, they will fuck us. You know, you can't come in and battle them and then just leave. You have to finish. And then, but then that is just like, what are you going to do? Create another fucking imperialist project? It's hard, man. There's no answer, really. There is no answer. War is brutal and it's fucked. And sometimes it's good to help. Sometimes it's not. I don't know, man.
War is such a wild thing if we think about it. Because it's always happened. It's never not happened. Do you ever, magic wand scenario, do you ever think it will ever stop? And if it did ever stop, do you think it would be better?
I mean, well, sure, peace would be better, but, war will never end, ever. It's human nature. It's definitely human nature. It's, I think a lot of people ignore that, especially in war reporting as well. I think a lot of the time people think that if this element was removed, we'd be living fine, or it was all the fault of the West, or it was all the fault of the East, or it was the Islamists, or it was the Nazis, or there's always going to be someone being a prick. You know, I mean, my dad used to be very anti-religion. My family are Irish, and, you know, witnessed, not personally, but they saw a lot of bad that the Catholic Church did in Ireland, you know,
totally.
Particularly with the paedophile scandal, just horrific.
Fuckers.
And creating this weird sense of superiority around the church. So our family were very anti-religion in that sense. I remember my dad used to be fuck religion. If we didn't have that, we'd have peace. And, you know, flippantly, I don't think he really believed that. But as I got older, I remember just thinking, well, that's bullshit. You know, people fight over which bit of grass is theirs. You know what I mean? And that's not to say that, you know, land disputes and liberation fights are not worthy. Of course they are. You know, you need your homeland. And, you know, patriotism, which is not the same as nationalism, despite what people say, patriotism is kind of saying, I like my people and the way we live, and I want to protect that. There's nothing wrong with that. I fucking hate the government. I hate the British state, and I hate the, like I said, my family are fucking Irish. They murdered my family. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I hate all that. But I love Britain. I love my people. I love my fucking neighbors. I love what I believe Britain is at the core. And that's not white or anything. That's all of us. You could be any fucking color and be British. Yeah. If you have the values that we have, you want to get on and you're just trying to, you know, I like that. And a lot of people live like that. And it gets very skewed in the media of nationalist this or they're just trying to take land. Often it's people trying to just protect the way they live. And the reason I'm pointing that out is because I just think that that's going to be like that forever, because each side thinks they're right.
Totally.
You know,
This
Azerbaijan-Armenia thing has been a very big issue. Karabakh is Armenian. Karabakh is Azeri. Well, I was saying, there were 5th century fucking Armenian cathedrals in Karabakh. I would argue that it's Armenians. But then who am I to say that? An Azeri could say, well, hey, we, you know, they, you know, there was massacres that Armenians carried out back in the day against Azeris, which they carried out as well against Armenians. So there is no real correct answer. You know what I mean?
And yeah, totally.
I don't think it's ever going to stop, mate, unfortunately. I really don't. I don't know how it could.
So the other day I was listening to your drone warfare podcast, and that
yeah,
gave
I love that episode,
that,
yeah.
That gave me the shits, man. That's
me as well.
And the one when they, it was like the drone. Are you still there? Hello.
Yeah, we broke up for a second.
Yeah, right, yeah, you're back on.
Yeah.
The drone that went through that car and then cut the dude up.
Bro, the like, what is it? Like, they call it like the fucking, I can't remember what they call it, man, but it's like a samurai sword drone. Yeah. That shit is scary, man.
So then it's really interesting because I listened to that podcast and then like maybe a week later, the UK announced that they're putting an extra 16 billion into the like
drone production.
Yeah, drone production. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting that I just listened to that podcast. And in that podcast, it was very clear that the British aren't really in anything to do with drones from that podcast. Obviously, well, they used them. We used them.
Sorry, go on.
We used them, but from what I kind of gathered, we weren't in the technology space at all. But I could be wrong.
No, you're not wrong in it. Well, you are in a way, but not in a way. Like we house a lot of the companies that do it. We let them trade. We give them stipends. Like we also hold the biggest fucking arms conferences where we let all these horrific dictatorships come to England and basically help each other oppress people with brutal killing technology. You know what I mean? So we are very much involved in that. We supply Turkey with a lot of like money, which helps them make drones, which they've been using in, you know, Azerbaijan to kill Armenians left and right. So we are involved very deeply. Actually, we just do it in a crafty way, you know.
Just don't put it out on the newspapers.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have Union Jacks on, but yeah, they very much got the British heart, if you like. You know what I mean? Unfortunately,
It's such a shame because it's obviously changing warfare, and I don't know if you've experienced any of it whilst reporting, but how. There's that classic Einstein quote that World War III will be fought by buttons and technology, and then World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. Like, obviously, you see it, and there are people that are fighting with sticks and stones.
Almost literally. I mean, yeah, a fucked up thing, but there was a situation recently with Indian troops and Chinese troops on the border. And they have like some weird agreement where they're not allowed to be armed. And they ended up in some skirmish and there were like guys smashing people in the head with rocks. They were like literally fist fighting. There's footage of just dashing rocks at each other. A few of them got like knocked off the side of a fucking mountain, you know, so that actually happened. Like that was this year. That was crazy. But in a sense, when I look at the Armenian situation, I bring that up again because it's recent and I've been focused on it a lot. And, you know, I very much like the kind of Armenian culture. I just find it very interesting. So I've read a lot about it. So in a way, you know, they've got fucking, they're a very poor country, really, in the grand scheme of things. They've got, you know, machine guns, AKs, whatever they've got. Few tanks, you know, but then the Azerbaijan were dropping drones almost daily, like big destructive drones, and the footage was just insane. You know, we spoke about them on that podcast, the suicide drones, they call them, or loitering munitions, which makes them sound nicer than they are. They're just drones that it's just a flying bomb that just they find where it is, someone controls it on like essentially a PlayStation controller and just goes like, whoom, and just bam, dead. So in a way, they're literally, it's like David and Goliath for them. They were fucked. You know, they lost a lot. They fought very, very hard, but you know, they had no chance really. And you could argue that like a lot, again, going back to the 3D printed gun guys, you know, the main guy in our documentary was arguing that, like, look at the resistance of Vietnam, look at the resistance of Afghanistan. You can fight these big governments with, like, small things in guerrilla warfare. Drones are actually, that was true until the drone technology started getting unbelievably just more technical and more advanced. You know, like, I do think that that's going to be a lot harder for guerrilla fighters and, like, separatist groups to rise up. How do you escape that? You know, like, they're not going to have anti-aircraft guns, and if they are, they've got to hit every time. You can send out, I think Britain actually was funding some kind of, was it Britain? It might have been Britain, was funding some kind of this new drone system where it's like a fleet of, oh no, it's China, a fleet of like suicide drones. I mean, if you shoot down one, 10 more are coming. You know, it's like getting snowballed by a group of, like, a gang at school. You know, you might dodge one, but they're all going to hit you eventually. And you can't really safeguard from that, you know, other than going underground and then, you know, you're not fighting anymore, are you?
No. Have you seen the documentary Don McCullen?
Yeah, I love him. Incredible. Absolutely amazing photographer. I love his work.
Absolutely amazing. And I've watched that documentary about four times. I think every time a mate comes around, I'm like, you have to watch this. It's kind of kind of mind blowing. Obviously, he talks about the kind of aftermath of what war has kind of had on him and being in these conflicts. Obviously, you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, but have you ever kind of experienced like PTSD or anything like that where it takes a long time, or maybe still?
I mean, I would say first, I've not seen anything compared to McCullen. Like, I've basically seen nothing compared, you know what I mean? I've seen some bad shit, but McCullen he saw everything, you know, like that. I love his work so much. He really believed in getting up close, and he took a lot of pictures that a lot of people said he shouldn't have taken, but I think he should.
Totally.
He had a great quote. This is not verbatim, but he said something like, I think people should be shocked whilst eating their cornflakes on a Sunday. Just meaning, like, you know, people need to know how bad this is, the horrific nature of violence and that in war. So I've not seen anything near as bad as him, and I've not experienced anywhere near as much danger. But I've seen enough I always said I've never had PTSD, but that was almost a bit of a hubris reaction from me after witnessing some journalists that almost revel in having it a little bit. You know, it becomes a bit of a thing they talk about at the bar. I'm very much against that. I don't. If you come for a drink with me, mate, I ain't talking about no war stories. Fuck that. No. This is my work. You know, you don't want to put everyone in a bad mood being like, look at you, I've seen shit, you know, like, it's not good.
It then becomes a dick swinging competition, doesn't it?
Exactly, which it never should be, you know. And certainly I make a lot of jokes, very dark jokes about war, but that's because I've almost inherited the comedy from the front line.
Yeah.
Like, militants, they deal with it with very dark comedy, and I really like the way they do that. And it's, people think it's crass of me, but it's, I don't think it is. It actually brings me closer to what they're experiencing. In my own head, is the way I deal with it.
I think it helps the actual situation when you're in it as well. I can't speak for myself, but friends that I know that are in the military and things like that,
very much so,
they're extremely dark people, and they have brutal sense of humor. And then you're like, well, actually, I get it. If you're in the worst of the worst, you're literally in the worst place that you can ever wish to be. You're killing people,
yeah,
or you're seeing people being killed, like. If you can't have a joke, then you're not going to be.
What else can you do? You know, exactly. And laughter can at least put a lot of fear just at the back of your mind. And also it's camaraderie, which you need if you're in a violent situation. You need people you can depend on and rely upon, you know, and that just comes into it. But in terms of like PTSD, I certainly realized as I got older, when I hit 30, like a lot of things really fucking hit me, man. And I think that some stuff that I witnessed at war that I kind of just tucked away in my head surfaced in different ways. Like you know, like I brought this up before to someone. It sounds really weird because it hit me so hard. But like a heartbreak, you know, like with a relationship, kind of hit me in a weird way that I think the war shit made it worse. You know, it was almost like the person that I knew would always understand and could talk to is now gone.
Yeah.
Not dead, but gone. And then it's almost like that shit came back and I was like, wow, that even if you didn't talk to them, just being around them or whatever made it better. And then you realize that now it's all surfaced again. My point is you need someone to talk to, I think. That's totally what I'm trying to say. And when you lose that support system, you fucking feel it more. So I think the way to kind of avoid the PTSD shocks is to have people to talk to, not even necessarily about the problems, but they'll just understand that, like, you know, there's a bit of darkness in you and they can just accept it and, like, you can talk about it. But certainly when I was in jail in Turkey, after that, I had some serious symptoms of PTSD that I didn't really realize they were PTSD until they went away and I started reading about PTSD a bit more. Nothing compared to what the actual, you know, people that are still in the jail there, like, yeah, experiencing horrible stuff. You know, I was a white kid with a red passport. I didn't experience anywhere near as bad as what it could have been. Trust me, I heard some bad shit in there and I know that weren't happening to me, but it was happening to other people. And it's just like, you know, afterwards, it really, I was like, yeah, that was a weird manifestation of PTSD. I mean, I feel okay now, you know, but certainly, you know, I struggle with like depression and shit. But I've kind of always been like that, you know, man, like I've kind of always been that guy, very dark humor since I was a kid, you know, like, and I just think if anything, the war stuff just made it, I don't even know if it made it worse. It actually almost put things into context for me sometimes. It's like, you know, I'm a big believer in, not, I don't mean this in a macho way, but sometimes don't be a crybaby. You know, there's a time and a place to let out your issues and don't burden people with it, because then you do feel guilty yourself as well, which makes it worse. You have to pick the right person and the right environment to talk to, you know, and actually a very good friend of mine killed himself a week ago.
Damn, sorry, man.
Yeah, bro. And fucking, and you know, for him, like, life was just too hard, you know, like there was no, I don't know, it just, there was almost no option. Now, there is always an option. You should never kill yourself. But you know what I mean? I understood within him that darkness, he just couldn't escape it, you know? So I think that some people, like, can't. But I think you should always fucking try. And to, you know, you just have to realize that, like, you know, I say this to a lot of people, everything is temporary, really. Everything, actually. And what, you know, life can change in an hour, let alone a day. So it's one of them ones where it's like, when I feel down with the PTSD shit, I think about, you know, the people that have died out there, that I know so many people that have died in war now, and just think, well, fuck it, man. I got to be here and got to keep going, because my job was not for a fucking powwow. I'm not a fucking war tourist.
Yeah.
It's there to be like, hey, they died for something, you know?
Yeah.
Whether I agree with it or not, I do have respect for people that died for something they believed in. So, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of rambling, but you get my drift, right?
No, man, I get it. I don't think it's as easy as a question to answer, with especially the fact that I've known you for not long, and it's kind of that thing. I don't want to talk too much about it, but Turkish prison, how did that happen?
Can I take a piss quickly?
Of course you can, mate. Sorry, I'm fine. So am I. I'm going to take one as well.
Okay, I'm back.
Quite possibly the best feeling in the world.
Oh, literally. Better than sex, man. So, sorry, what are you asking?
Turkish prison. How the hell did this happen? And what's the process of going on now?
Because I'm still asking myself, mate, honestly. So, me and two very close friends of mine that I worked with a lot when I was at Vice, my friend Phil Pendlebury and Mohammed Rasool, we were filming. It was the third time we were filming with this Kurdish militant youth group. Basically like a liberation group. They're rising up in southeast Turkey, where the Kurds mainly live. Historically, that would be North Kurdistan, or Bakur as they call it. And you know, the Turkish government has just been brutally oppressing them for a very long time. You know, like, there's videos from, like, I think 1994 or 96 of them going into this little tiny town, Jizra, where we went, just rounding up old people, like shooting them, you know. Jesus. Like, the unbelievable levels of torture. It was illegal to speak their own language, you know, real levels of oppression. So they've been fighting for a very long time. There's a movement, a militant group called the PKK, they're like the Turkish side of that other group I was talking about, the YPG.
Yeah.
Let me delete that. And is my mic still on?
Yeah, you're still on.
It says it's disconnected.
No, it's definitely still on.
Okay. Yeah, and so we were reporting on this youth group basically that rose up. They were like the next generation, if you like. You know, they were back. They were like, we're gonna take over the lands and you know, we're gonna rise up and have our own territory, basically.
Yeah.
You know, officially they say they wanted an autonomous zone. A book I'm writing about them now, I'm calling it that. But really they wanted free Kurdistan, you know, they wanted their land. And obviously the Turkish government said it's not your land. So, you know, there's just been this brutal fighting. And it was real like street to street urban warfare, like really crazy. Like the fighting was like, you know, like in town, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like the front line was between people's houses.
Damn.
So we were covering all that, got in at the height of the war, which it was like really brutal. Like loads of them just getting slaughtered. You're talking about like most of them teenagers with like, you know, weapons they dug out of the ground that they'd buried whilst the peace process was on. Yeah. You know, some of them, they were making a lot of homemade bombs. Some of them had like small rocket launchers. But, you know, NATO's second largest army, they had no chance. And they set up like, really stupidly, they set up like static positions rather than guerrilla warfare, if you like.
Yeah.
And for a while, they took over their whole areas. To be honest, like they kept the military out for a long time. It was actually incredible how they managed it. Kurds are very like adept at warfare just from years of fighting. In all four parts of Kurdistan, they'd just, you know, been fighting governments. And basically, yeah, we were filming with them. And when we were in their areas where like the police and the military couldn't step foot in, it was all right. But then we went to an area that was kind of contested. Like part of it they'd taken, part of it was, well, most of it was very much still under control of the Turkish government.
Yeah.
And one day, man, they just picked us up, arrested us. They were like, "You're terrorists," randomly accused us of being ISIS at first, and we were like, "What?" Like, I don't think I've ever really done an ISIS story. Even they just wanted to look at our footage, basically, you know. And there is no real, like, you know, the police and the government don't have to follow anything there; they can do what they want. You know, it's a regime essentially. That's the way it is. So we knew the risks, but at that time, it was a lot more open. It was actually a surprise to get arrested. It really wasn't. They weren't arresting journalists en masse, you know, like they are now. Like I said, second biggest jail of journalists worldwide now. It definitely was not that back then at all. So they arrested us. We were in jail for like 11 days, me and my friend Phil. Our friend Rasul, he's a Kurd. Now, a Kurd in prison in Turkey is not good, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, just living there is hard enough. But so he was kept for 131 days. But Jesus. Thank God, like, he's out now and he's free, he's good. But yeah, man, they just arrested us and they kept putting us in. We were in like four or five different prisons, just kept putting us in these mad max security jails, like terror prisons. Fucking, even when we got released, we had to spend 3 days in a deportation prison with all these Chechen ISIS guys that had been caught on the border because they'd been fighting in Syria and they would come into Turkey to get treatment in the hospitals. Believe it or not, that, you know, that was happening. I don't think they asked too many questions. And, you know, we were in there and there was this one fucking guy, like this Chechen ISIS guy with like bullet wounds, like open wounds in his arm. And like his mate was like helping him every day. And it's like, where the fuck did you guys just come from? We're just trying to go home, man. So, yeah, mate, we did all that little bit of time in jail in Turkey. And stupidly, the court case is just going on for 5 years, you know, charged with terrorism and aiding and abetting or something like that. Didn't do anything. We didn't help them at all. We filmed them. Like, I mean, if anything, they, you know, we had some quite strong questions for them. Because I was saying to these youth, like, you know, are you really ready for this? Like, you've just murdered some police. Like, you know, did them police deserve it? Were they, you know, I get it. It's a war. But we weren't like, well done, guys. Like, well, they're as reporters. Now, you know, obviously, you know, I'm openly pro-Kurdish independence, you know. Totally. I think why they're the biggest race of people on earth without their own country, essentially.
Yep.
So I'm like, yeah, sure, they should have their own land. Like the same way I'm pro-Irish republicanism, you know, I think Ireland should be reunified.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
they saw that as you are a terrorist, essentially, you know. And, you know, that was what it was. To be honest, though, like over there, if you're not 100% speaking the government line, you're a terrorist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like sense. Last week there was a park, like a children's park, and there was a big star as like, you know, like the foam on the floor. They have like patterns. And it looked a tiny bit like the symbol of the PKK. And they like, I think they arrested the guy that got it built and like dug the whole park up in like a day and destroyed it. It's like, it's a very fragile way to be, you know? So
does that mean that you can't travel anywhere?
No, I can travel wherever, but I can't travel to certain places. Like I wouldn't be able to go to Azerbaijan, for example, which, you know, is considered like little Turkey.
Okay.
There's certain countries I wouldn't risk going to. You know, it's probably fine, but you never know. We're not particularly on top of the list of who Turkey cares about. You know, we're not militants. We're not trying to hurt anyone. But certainly if we piss them off, you never know. An official might find out we're in a country and we might get spirited away. The next thing we wake up deported in Turkey, you know, like Kosovo, which is again, one of the EU's like best pals. I think last year or the year before just randomly arrested, like I think 4 Kurdish like dissidents who'd left Turkey because they were going to be arrested and just basically kidnapped them and just sent them to Turkey. It's completely against the law. Completely against the laws they're meant to be a part of within, like, you know, trying to join the EU and, or are they in the EU? I forget, whatever it is, but there is whatever network they're in, it's against it. Again, nothing happened to them. There was no punishment whatsoever. The government went, well, we don't know who did that. Like, you don't know who arrested and deported them. Like, you know what I mean? Who
fucking was it? So what's next, man? Like you've got the 3D printing documentary coming out. What have you got kind of planned? What's exciting you? What do you feel like you have to talk about?
So next year, you know, the Patreon's doing well now. We're at a point where we can, it's just me, like there's no like team. Yeah. I mean, there's a team as in like me, my friend Sam, he makes all the music. Essentially, me and him did it all together from day one. A lad, Adam Doyle, spicebag.exe on Instagram. Check him out, he's sick.
Great name.
Great name, yeah, Irish lad. Fucking, he does a lot of our graphics. But basically, like, we've got to a point now where we can kind of, like, hire out freelance team, if you like. You know, there are boys in that, but I believe in paying everybody, you know.
Totally.
Like, when we had nothing, I said, look, you want to work with us, it's fine, but I can't give you nothing. Now we've got money, a bit of money. It's like everyone's got to eat, you know what I'm saying? I want it to be good like that. So we're slowly building up to that point where, you know, the big project I want to do is a series called Bad Signal. So it will be Popular Front, but it will be a series we do. Popular Front presents Bad Signal, whatever. The name might change, I don't know. But basically, it will be a series where we travel to all of these underreported conflicts that you just don't see in the news. Yeah. That will be the tagline, the wars you won't see in the news, you know? And it's just, you know, I mean, I got a list here, like Nagorno-Karabakh, Ukraine is still going on. There's an Ambazonian English-speaking insurgency near Nigeria, wherever it is, Rojava, I'd like to go back there, the Polisario like situation in Western Sahara, like these big wars going on. Congo has about 10 different wars kicking off right now. You just don't see them, or if you do, it's very little coverage. I would like to do a series where we go and do a whole episode in that country on the front line with civilians, with whoever, both sides if we can, just saying like, hey, here's what you don't know about, here's what you should know, and here's what it looks like. You know, my aim with journalism is always just to be, you know, young lads, young women like me or whatever age, to just go like, oh, I didn't know about that. Now I do. You know, that's what I really want to do. You know, I'm not like out here trying to win awards or any bullshit. To be honest, journalism awards is a big racket. I saw it, trust me. But, you know, I just want to kind of like just go to these underreported places. You know, and Popular Front is known for covering them kind of things. So I think the next step would be to do like, you know, a whole series on it, really.
No, man, I absolutely love what you do. And definitely keep it up. And if I can help at all, just let me know. Like, if I can promote anything, just send everything my way and I can talk about it.
Yeah.
I can do it.
I mean, if I can just plug the Patreon.
Of course, man. Of course.
Yeah. So the way, like I said, the way we're funded is through Patreon mostly. And it's not just like supporters help us, we do bonus episodes. We have a whole video series on there. It's called Too Cool for J School. It's kind of a joke. Like, J School is journalism school. I never went to it, and I don't think you need to go to it to learn. You can do, but like, we have a whole video series kind of saying, like, here's things you need to learn if you want to be a journalist or whatever. We have like narrated articles. We have this like amazing like research community Discord where it's just like everybody's in the group just doing all like mad research into something. I don't understand half of it, like much smarter people than me there, man. And yeah, there's a lot. You get a lot. You get like early access to episodes, you know, just loads of stuff is going on there. Patreon.com/popularfront. And if you want to see the doc, go to youtube.com/popularfront. You know, it will be up today if FedEx ever deliver my fucking hard drive, but we'll see.
Nice one, man. Well, thanks for coming on. It's been really good to catch up, and hopefully we can do it again at some point over the years.
Yeah, when COVID's down, let's get well, I know you don't drink, but let's drink juice or something, you know.
Big love, man. And if anyone can follow you on Instagram, it's same Instagram.com/
So the popular front one, you're better off following that. It's a popular.front. If you want to follow me, it's Jake_Hanrahan, HANRAHAN. Nearly forgot my own fucking surname.
Mate, I've been trying to get my head around your surname.
Do you know what? Yeah, like the Irish surname in Ireland, it's so easy. Everyone's like Hanrahan, of course.
Yeah.
In England, everyone's like Hanrahan.
You know, like, I always just want to say Hanrahan because I like
everyone says that.
Yeah.
Hanrahan, yeah. Hanrahan. But no, I understand, man. It's funny, like a lot of my friends, like, I got like African friends, and they got like really hard to say surnames. And I'm like, oh, I understand you're struggling. And they're like, shut the fuck up. You know what I mean? But yeah,
Are you in London?
Nah, man, Midlands.
Midlands. Whereabouts?
I mean, I'm like, it's like an hour away. I'm often in London, man.
Yeah. Okay, cool, man. Well, yeah, after COVID, let's catch up.
100%, man. Thank you very much.
Big love. Keep safe, mate. Take care.
Thanks, man. Bye bye.
And that is a wrap. I know that podcast was completely different to what I kind of usually do. But it was really important to me that I got somebody like Jake on the podcast. These things kind of really matter to me. And I hope that it kind of helped everybody in listening and kind of educated a little and maybe not, and kind of caused some opinions and maybe caused some people to go dig in and learn a little bit more about what Jake spoke about. Please go support him, patreon.com/popularfront. Follow him on all of his platforms. I put all the links in the bio of the podcast as well. Anyway, if you did enjoy it, please share it with your friends, talk about it on social media, and yeah, just keep doing you. Love you lots. Keep safe. See you soon.
What if you could have a career where the opportunities are as vast as our nation, where it's not about mission statements, but a shared mission? At U.S. Customs and Border Protection, we go beyond to protect more than borders. From ship to shore, air to ground, cities to local communities, CBP agents and officers are keeping people safe. Join U.S. Customs and Border Protection and go beyond for something far greater than yourself. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.